Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up on the show today, the government thinks you're stupid. The government thinks you're too dumb to understand why your rates are going up when it comes to your energy costs. We're going to talk about this scheme that's happening to hide yet another financial impact of Washington State's carbon tax. To me, it's one of the most scandalous stories I think we've seen in Washington State in a very long time, and that is certainly saying something. Meanwhile, Bob Ferguson, speaking of scandal, because he's involved in that story we're going to discuss, he's preparing to make his exploratory campaign for governor official. We'll discuss the when and the where. Also, is the teachers' union too powerful? We asked the man in charge of the state's public education system. I thought his reaction to that question was interesting. Also, unbelievable deflection that we're seeing on violent crime in our state and how too many in the media and too many politicians simply refuse to be honest about some of the underlying issues that are leading to it. All of that coming up and more. But first, if you have not become a subscriber to the show already, please do so. Help us continue this show, grow this mission and this movement. I will also note that we're having our monthly live Q&A with subscribers tonight with special guest Nicole Thompson. Nicole's probably, is this your first one, Nicole? Is this going to be your first live Q&A?
Yes.
They need to go sign up, undividedpod.com. Right. You can only join the live Q&A and ask us anything that your heart desires. It's tonight at 7 p.m. So sign up, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. Get your best, hardest questions for Nicole since she's never done one of these. All right. The next story, as I teased it, I think it's one of the most scandalous stories that we've seen because it has everything I hate about the government. It has government ineptitude involved in it. It has government scandal in it. It has the government blatantly saying that you're too dumb to understand something that is very simple to understand for the average person. And I think it also has corruption. And it involves an office, the Attorney General's office, where the Attorney General is now seeking to be the most powerful person in our state. He wants to be the governor. And this is just one of many, many stories that have come up in recent months that I think render him unfit for the governor's office, that I think should be disqualifying for any reasonable voter who expects the government to serve them, expects the government to be honest to them. So here, there's multiple, we actually kind of knew this story was coming because we had Todd Myers of the Washington Policy Center on the show last week, and he's been very involved in tracking the impacts of Washington State's new carbon tax, which of course has had this tremendous impact for people at the pump, but also in other areas as well. And he kind of had slipped it to us. He says, hey, I'm looking into something, so be on the lookout for this story. So there are several news outlets now that have covered this. One of them is The Chronicle, the headline, Washington AG's office advised Utilities Commission to conceal carbon tax impact on energy rates. Let me read just the first couple paragraphs from this article. And this is written actually by the Center Square, republished in the Chronicle. Earlier this month, the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission approved a request by Puget Sound Energy to increase their natural gas rates to cover the costs of the state's cap and trade program under the Climate Commitment Act. However, the approval also carried with it a stipulation that the utility provider could not show on customers' bills the reason for the rate increase, a decision that was recommended by the Washington Attorney General's office. So, a couple things. First, you have yet another acknowledgement here from the state itself that yes, the cap and trade program leads to price increases for us. It leads to price increases at the pump. It is now leading to price increases if you're a Puget Sound Energy customer. And PSC told the UTC, again, the Utilities and Transportation Commission, it needed a 3.25% increase in overall bills for all natural gas customers to generate $16.8 million required to cover their losses under the carbon tax program, the cap and trade program. So again, we have two things happening here simultaneously. One, yet another thing that acknowledges what we already know is, of course, the carbon tax is increasing costs for us. Of course it is. We know this. We're not dumb. But the second thing is, which I think is the most egregious element of this, is they want to hide it from you. On the advice of the Attorney General's office, PSC goes to the Utilities Commission and says, hey, we need a rate increase to cover the increases and the losses as a result of the carbon tax. and the Attorney General's office goes to them and say, okay, if you're going to do this, make sure it's not a line item on people's bills. So that when you and I see that our Puget Sound energy bill is higher, that we won't associate it with the cap and trade program. Why? Because the governor doesn't want people to know that that program is costing them money because it's not politically popular. This is insane. This is a scandal of insane proportions. And again, I'll go back to Todd Myers with the Washington Policy Center, who has been right on every single aspect of what the cap and trade program would do. He wrote about this for Washington Policy Center. His headline, Washington State Utility Commission brazenly dishonest ruling admits climate tax increase prices. In it, he wrote, in a remarkably brazen decision, the UTC commissioners wrote, quote, we agree with public counsel, again, the Attorney General's office, that PSC should not include the proposed carbon reduction charge as a line item on customers' bills. Todd writes, what reason did they cite for hiding their decision from customers whose bills have increased? They say it would be confusing. Quote, public counsel correctly observes that including all program charges on customers' bills would quickly result in lengthy and confusing bills. So simply put, they think you're stupid. Their excuse for gaslighting you to hide something that is not politically popular and that Democrats don't want you to know about is to call you stupid and to say, hey, if we put that on their bill, they'll get confused by it. Todd writes, it gets worse. The, quote, public counsel referred to by the UTC commissioners is Nina Switaki, who works in the office of the Attorney General. The job of public counsel is to represent ratepayers at utility hearings. Switaki previously worked at TURN, a California advocacy group who lists their top priority as creating energy equity and climate justice. For the love of God, again, let's try to consume that bit by bit. So here you have a public counsel. It's an attorney at the Attorney General's office. Her job, her specific job at the Attorney General's office is to represent your interests, ratepayers. But instead of doing that, this woman, who used to work for a California-based advocacy group, which lists their top priority as creating energy equity and climate justice, recommended that that line item, that the increase related to the governor's carbon tax, which is related to his climate agenda, that it not be put on your bill. Yet she's a public attorney who's supposed to be representing the interests of ratepayers? No, what is she representing? She's representing the interests of climate activists. She's representing the interests of Governor Jay Inslee, who has tried at every juncture to hide from you what the real impacts to your pocketbook would be from his carbon tax, which was his baby, his pet project. You guys, this is crazy stuff. Again, people should lose their jobs over this. That attorney should lose her job over this. I genuinely think that this is something that could get people or should get people taken out of office. I just want to go through one more time just to really underscore the scandal involved in this. And this is not a political issue. I'm not looking at this through the lens of someone who has a political bias or a political agenda. I would encourage Republican, Democrat, wherever you are on the spectrum, to really look at this absent any sort of political considerations for the party of the people involved. From the very beginning, Governor Jay Inslee wanted a carbon tax. He thinks it's necessary to save the planet. Okay. He does it. He denies for years that that carbon tax would increase prices at the pump. He denies it for years until he can't deny it anymore because gas prices went up about 50 cents per gallon explicitly because of that carbon tax. So what does Jay Inslee do? He says, okay, well, I can't deny it anymore, so now I'll blame it on the greedy gas and oil companies. Let's put the blame on rich people so people don't put the blame on me. And this past legislative session, what did state lawmakers try to do? Well, they wanted to make sure that people who are buying gas from oil companies, like owners of gas stations, they moved to make sure that there wasn't a line item on that bill, that it couldn't say this is the increase related to the carbon tax. Thankfully, they failed, but they tried to do it. So now you fast forward, Puget Sound Energy comes forward and says, hey, yeah, we're down a couple $1 million because of the carbon tax and the impacts from it. We need rate hikes. We need roughly 3% rate hikes for consumers. Utility Commission says, okay. And the Attorney General's office says, hey, by the way, when you do that, when you grant that rate hike, don't put a line item on there that tells people it's tied to the carbon tax. Defend that. Defend that, Jay Inslee. Defend that, Bob Ferguson. Every single reporter in the state should be demanding that both of those men defend that. It's indefensible. It's not political. It's lying. It's lying to people about something as critical as their budget. And it's coming from two men who don't have to worry when they stand at a gas pump about whether filling up their tank will mean they can't feed their family. It's coming from two men who don't look at their PSE bill and notice an increase of $10, $15, because that doesn't matter to them, but it does matter to a lot of Washington families across the political spectrum. And they think, again, this is what they said. They think you're too dumb. Their argument is you're too dumb to understand it. If they put those line items on your bills, it'll just confuse you. So just pay it, okay? Just pay it. Don't ask questions. Don't ask questions about why your bill is higher this month. Don't ask questions about why you have to reevaluate your family's budget because suddenly your money's not going as far. Suddenly your bills are higher. Suddenly the price at the pump is higher. Don't question it. They're doing this for you. They're doing you a favor so your bill isn't so freaking confusing. How nice of them. You guys, this is what's wrong with government, and this is what's wrong with one-party rule. This is what I do this freaking show for. We need balance in the state of Washington. I don't care if you're a Democrat and you're thinking, well, this is nice. My party's in charge of everything. When your party's in charge of everything, they do stuff like this because you've given them that much unchecked power, and they know that they can get away with it in the current environment. They're not worried about losing their seats. They're not worried about election consequences. If they were worried about either of those things, they wouldn't do stuff like this. And if there were a media ecosystem that gave a damn about what should be their primary responsibility, holding powerful people accountable, they wouldn't think they can get away with stuff like this. But the media went soft on them a long time ago. I'm genuinely pissed off about this, because I don't like it when they mess with people's money and then lie about it and then gaslight people about it and say, we tell you why your bills go up, but you're too dumb to understand. Certainly not related to our climate agenda. How dare you? That's insane. This is not the last you're going to hear us talk about this story. And I will note that one of the people who I think is to blame for this, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who has shown time and time again that he is perfectly comfortable with hiding things from the people who he is supposed to serve, he's going to make his exploratory campaign for governor official, as if we didn't think it was official already. The email he sent out, Bob Ferguson campaign launch, Saturday, September 9th. So about 2 weeks away, Bob Ferguson, he's going to be in the Tri-Cities making his exploratory campaign for governor official. The email says, as part of his exploratory campaign, Bob visited all 39 counties and earned endorsements from 200 plus elected officials and nearly 20 labor unions representing 200,000 workers. They don't say where the event's going to be. I don't particularly blame them for that, but they say if you RSVP, they'll send you a location 48 hours in advance. I wonder why Bob Ferguson in the Tri-Cities would be worried about publicizing the location of his campaign kickoff. But I just, and we're going to have a couple stories about real missteps from the local media when it comes to holding powerful people accountable. But when it comes to Bob Ferguson, I mean, the stories have been there. We've heard time and time again stories about public disclosure lapses in his office, his office offering advice to hide from you the reason why your energy rates are going up. He's lost so much taxpayer money with frivolous cases that he's brought for political clout. And now after his exploratory campaign, he's going to officially be a candidate for governor. He already was. And I really hope that the media has it in them to do what needs to be done and to hold him accountable for his record and for stories like this. Crazy stuff. I'm sure, Nicole, the comments are lighting up today. Thought so. Okay. On Sundays with Subscribers this week, we had on the superintendent of public instruction, Chris Reichdahl. I highly recommend you go watch the interview if you have not already. And look, we've been very critical of the public education system. Do I think all teachers are bad? No. Do I think some of these wild stories we hear about political and social agendas being pushed on kids is the norm in every classroom in the state? Absolutely not. But it's our job to highlight them. And when I hear these stories, I wonder, well, how much stuff are we not hearing about? So we talked to him about all of that. But also, I think we had an interesting exchange about teachers' unions. We are heading into a school year, and I'm sure parents are always like, well, should I make plans for potentially if there's a strike? Because those always happen to come up just days before the school year is scheduled to get underway. And teachers' strikes, by the way, in our state are not protected under the law. But you'll notice that someone like Attorney General Bob Ferguson doesn't seem to say anything about him. Teachers will strike right before the school year, and even though it's not protected under the law, do you think Bob Ferguson says anything? No, because the teachers union is incredibly powerful and Democrats rely on the teachers union. They kowtow to the teachers union. So anyway, I asked, again, the man in charge of our public education system about the power of the teachers union and whether it has gotten out of control. Here's part of our conversation from yesterday's episode of Sundays with Subscribers. There is a belief among a big segment of certainly our viewers and listeners, myself included, that the teachers union is far too powerful when it comes to what happens in our public education system. Do you think the teachers union has too much power? Do you think they're more powerful than you?
No.
Well, I don't know.
I don't think they have too much power because I don't think it's a relationship based on who gets power and there's a fixed sum. We collectively bargain in this state, so you've got management that brings all the money and the resources and the personnel decisions, and you've got folks who are collectively bargaining to try to look out for the best interest of their members. That is a natural relationship. It doesn't happen in every state. And so when somebody like me looks at those other states and I say, do you want your kids to go to school in Alabama or Mississippi or Arkansas or South Carolina, where they have essentially squashed all the ability for the professionals to have big voice, the compensation there relative to other jobs is very low. It shows in their NAEP scores, so the national assessment where we get to look against each other. We're still a top 15 state in the nation, and those states are very, very, very low. So there is no absolute, as you can imagine, Brandy. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before. I don't believe in absolutes, that it's one way or the other. People can disagree with even having organized labor. I think it's important. They can disagree with the power of management versus labor. I think we have a good balance in this state. I think it's important that professionals lead their profession. Nobody thinks doctors have too much power. But they get all those clinical decisions. They are pushing back against hospital administrators. They have enormous influence on what happens in terms of certification of drugs. They're on all of the panels. No one thinks a firefighter has too much power, and they're the ones on the front lines risking their lives to put out fires. So it's a good, healthy debate. It's just not one where I'm ever going to vilify them, because I think this state's education system is excellent because of teachers and because of organized labor. I think we are a better state.
If they don't have too much power, how can they get away with strikes that they do not have legal protection to engage in? When other unions would not, other public sector unions who are prohibited under law from striking would not get such leniency.
Yeah, there is a gray area there, right? So the general rule is that the public sector doesn't strike. And then in some cases, our legislature has said some of these law enforcement corrections workers, it's such a high risk to not have them on the job that they get binding arbitration rights so they can force a conclusion sooner.
And I agree with that, by the way. I don't think that police officers and first responders should be able to strike.
The reason I say it's a gray area is would you put teachers in that situation?
Yes.
That's up for people to debate. You say yes. What I say is we have a constitutional obligation to 180 school days and 1,000 instructional hours. So if you go on strike, which I think is generally quite healthy in labor, you don't get out from underneath any of those days. We make them up. You're going to go to school till late June or early July or the middle of July. So the work contract is always honored, but it can be terribly disruptive for families. I recognize that.
Right, but it's illegal for them to strike. They do not have protection under the law to strike in our state.
And a local school district can go to a local superior court and have them unwind that. And sometimes the superior court has ordered them back in, and sometimes they have not.
But do you think it's truly appropriate for them to, when there is no clear legal protection, when we've talked about the importance of having kids in classrooms? Mm-hmm. You said they're going to make up every day, but what, during the summer? I mean, it's not as if that comes with no sacrifice for kids, mm-hmm. for parents who find out at the last minute that they've got to find something to do with their kids for the next 2 weeks or for some unforeseeable amount of time. I find it to be very selfish.
Well, I don't, but I do think it's complicated, and it can be disruptive for families. There's no question about that. We find that families are on both sides of this, that they're frustrated, and others say, hey, we want the best educators in the world, and we know the only reason Washington State teachers can compete with big software, right, and big professional organizations in our state is to make sure they get the salaries that they deserve, the benefits that they deserve, and that happens at the local bargaining table in the state of Washington and states around the country. So fundamentally, with total disagreement with you, I'm sure, I believe everybody has the right to organize, to collectively bargain, and to withhold their labor if that is absolutely what they have to do for their own success and survival. And in the case of public ed, if that happens, we are still making up all that learning. We're still focused on all that learning. A teacher is very different than a law enforcement officer or corrections officer in terms of the acute public health risk of that.
They have these sort of planned strikes that come up at the last minute, you know, right when kids are getting back to go to school, because that's when they have maximum leverage. They did that when there was all this federal money coming in around COVID, and now you have school districts that are having to lay off support staff. I mean, we saw the stories out of Shoreline, for instance. So, I mean, do you have these teachers who engaged in illegal strikes to get more money for themselves at the expense of the quality of a kid's education?
No, I don't believe there's a single budget cut happening in the state as a result of collective bargaining or the compensation that people are owed. You absolutely have a state that has 39,000 and rapidly shrinking distance between maximum enrollment, peak mm-hmm. enrollment, and where we are today. That comes with an amount of money from the state. So yes, there was federal money, but there was nearly $500 million a year lost in state dollars. That is the reason that there's financial distress.
not at all because teachers demanded higher salaries.
That is bargained.
Yeah. So you can watch that whole interview, undividedpod.com. I was reading the angry responses from subscribers who are like, that man got around so many questions. Look, I think Chris Reichdahl's a nice guy. I'm glad he came in to talk. At least he comes in to talk about these issues. We certainly have a lot of disagreement. I mean, we covered COVID and their response and how they might change things moving forward. We talked about whether test scores are really the barometer for how Washington's public school system is doing. So I encourage you to watch the interview. I will say, and Nicole, can you, while I rant a little bit, find the response that the that his office gave to us about Marysville.
Okay.
Yeah, if you could pull that up, I'm going to have you read that momentarily. But a couple things here about, I mean, obviously, I think his response at the beginning when I said, do you think the teachers union is too powerful? He said, no. I said, are they more powerful than you? He goes, no. I mean, I was like, if that's not indicative of like how scared politicians are of the power of the teachers union, I don't know what is. But he said, you know, I don't think that collective bargaining is responsible for any of these cuts we're seeing. Well, we just saw a story last week, the Marysville School District cited specifically, I mean, a list of things. I don't think that teacher salary is the only thing to blame, but Marysville cited specifically teacher negotiations. Nicole, do you have the response? So that was after we taped the interview with Chris Reichdahl, and then that Marysville story came out after Chris had told us, like, I don't think that collective bargaining is to blame for these cost cuts at all. So we reached out to this office. We said, hey, here's what the Marysville School District said. Do you want to read your question that you posed to them, the wording from the article, and then just the response?
My question, let's see, I quoted the story and I said, would you share with him and get a reaction, a response, or a clarification before we post the story and what he said? Because the quote from him was that that I don't think there is a single budget cut that's happening in our state that's a result of collective bargaining. His response to me was, the superintendent stands by his comment. The school districts in our state who are in difficult financial situations are facing these challenges for a multitude of reasons. Many of these districts are navigating declining student enrollments and rising costs of goods and services. In the case of Marysville, they went an entire year without collecting local levy dollars. To attribute financial challenges to one single issue would not be an accurate representation of the complexity of a school district budgeting.
And I don't disagree with that. And I'm not trying to attribute it just to teacher pay. I don't think I've ever tried to attribute it just to teacher pay. But
that was his quote.
Right. Your budget issues. And yeah, he said, I don't think there's a single, that's directly attributable to teacher pay, and clearly Marysville disagrees with that. But of course, a budget issue, and when you're having a budget shortfall, of course there's going to be a variety of factors. No one is arguing that. I'm certainly not arguing that. But to suggest that if teacher pay goes up, that doesn't take money out of your budget is just ridiculous. Of course it does. If you have higher teacher pay, you're going to have to account for that somewhere else. But the other thing I would say, and we talked about this on the show yesterday, is he's attributing most of the budgetary issues in public schools to a couple things. One of them is declining enrollment. Okay. And he said, so school districts lost out on money because you have fewer students. Well, then you don't need that money. If the state is giving you money per student and you have students who've left, not having the money for the students who aren't there anymore isn't a budget deficit. That's an opportunity to just not take that money from the state. So it's just like a government way of thinking, and it's just totally absurd. And then, of course, you had money that came in during the pandemic. Okay, that was emergency money. You can't rely on that moving forward. And I certainly hope that you didn't build any sort of budgets around emergency COVID funding. That seems ridiculous. And I think it was in the case of Marysville where they said, we're also dealing with expected revenue that didn't manifest from the state or something like that.
I've heard both Marysville and Shoreline say that. They said they thought the legislature was going to give them money.
I don't build my budget around money I think I'm going to get that I've never received before. I build my budget around money I know is coming in. If you get a paycheck, and let's say your paycheck is $2,500 every two weeks, that's what a normal human being in a normal family and a normal American builds their budget around. They don't say, hey, in 6 months, I'm thinking maybe I'm going to get a raise. I'm thinking maybe I'm going to get a $10,000 bonus. Yep. I'm going to spend that money now. Yeah. And then it doesn't manifest. You're like, oh, what happened?
Yeah. Well, you said you were going to give it to me.
Right. That's ridiculous. It's budgeting 101. Every family and every American does it. But somehow we send people into office and into public positions. And now they're not budgeting their money. It's taxpayer money that they think is just manifesting out of thin air. And so they all of a sudden lose their ability to budget. It's weird, weird stuff. You can tell I'm on a bender today. I'm in a bad mood today because I'm just super stressed out.
I noticed.
And then Nicole noticed. But I think it's giving me a little more energy to tell these people off.
So perfect stories for
perfect
that
stories
today.
Perfect stories for this today. But anyway, go check that full interview out with Chris Reichdahl if you also want to be ragey today. But we do appreciate him coming in. All right. We've been talking about Sell With Wes, wonderful real estate agent in our area. If you're even thinking about at the precipice of thinking about selling your home, please check out sellwithwes.com. He and his team offer something really cool called the Listing Boost Concierge Service. You're not going to see it elsewhere. Where if you need, some updates to your home before you sell it, they can come in and help you with everything. You don't have to lift a finger. That was the case for Susan in Federal Way, who'd reached out to a few real estate agents, never got a call back, called Wes Jones with sellwithwes.com, got back to her right away, and he said, hey, I think we can help you out.
I knew I had to paint. I knew I needed to get new flooring. I needed to get new lighting. I told him up front that I was very interested, that I did not have the time or the finances to do what needed to be done. And he immediately jumped in I do. Work started immediately. And I would say in 2 to 3 weeks, they had landscaping done. They had all the painting done. The new floors were put in. All the lighting was put in. It just was all so fast. And the rest is history. It was on the market for 7 days. I was able to get well over listing price.
To be specific, Susan got 20 offers, sold it for 15% over list price, and ended up getting $200,000 more than an investor offered her before the renovations. Now, great is that? That's like the best sponsor success story ever. One call to sellwithwest.com, and she ended up getting $200,000 more for her home than she otherwise would have. Great stuff. Sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. If you're just thinking about selling your home, start by using their home value calculator. You can plug in your address, see how much your home is really worth, and it might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. Okay, another shooting in Seattle, and the mayor of Seattle has some interesting ideas as to what is to blame for all of this and also what he thinks might help. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. Boop. Okay, so yet another shooting in Seattle. I mean, these are becoming more and more commonplace. We clearly have an issue with our violent crime crisis, and I'm going to talk about all the reasons that crime crisis exists, unlike some of our other friends in the media who seem to blatantly be ignoring it, but that is for a story coming up later on in the show. So this is an article from Como News. Or do you want to play the video first? Let's play the video first. So Como did a story about there had been a recent shooting at a community event in South Seattle, which is horrifying. You had a lot of people there who weren't involved in any sort of illicit activity. I think it was a month ago now, the shooting, five people were injured. It was in a Rainier Beach Safeway parking lot. So anyway, Como News caught up with Mayor Bruce Harrell in South Seattle to talk about what's happening with all this violence.
In our country, we're seeing unprecedented levels of violence and gun misuse, hatred.
He says the city seeks out organizations like faith-based groups that can help with outreach to help people in need before they resort to violence.
How do we use our health organizations, primarily funded by the state and by the county, because the city of Seattle is not a continuum of care organization. How do we partner with them to make sure people are getting treated?
Word soup. What are you going to treat them for? What are you going to treat them for? These are gang members. The vast, vast majority of these shootings that are happening in South Seattle are gang members. So what are you going to treat them for? I don't understand what he means by that. And again, you heard him revisit there his old line about, oh, this is a national problem. This is a national problem because he doesn't want to own the fact that in Seattle it's getting worse and worse. I don't care about where Seattle compares. I don't know how many times I have to say. I do not care about where Seattle's numbers of crime compare to any other freaking city or any other state in the country. We don't live there. I'm not comparing us to Chicago. I'm not comparing us to any other major city that has had crime crises forever and ever. We're supposed to be a world-class city, so I don't want to hear those comparisons. And when we have a clear rise in violent crime here and in shootings, I don't want to hear the mayor of Seattle discount as, oh, this is a national phenomenon. But that aside, he went on to say in this article on Como News, for some reason they didn't include it in their story on the air, but they did include it in their written story. His quote is, how do we make sure we do lawful and constitutional arrests when people are threatening others? It's all coming together with how we help, we assist, we treat, and how we have to make arrests when we have to. I'm not afraid to say that a compassionate approach often will entail arrests as well. Oh, you're not afraid to say that we should arrest people who shoot other human beings? And it's some sort of epiphany that our response to that ought to include arrests? You think? Is that the brilliance that you're bringing to this issue? Help me understand. And none of this is new. This idea in this concept that we need to do what we can to prevent people from falling into a life of crime and gang violence. Of course, that's not new. People have been saying that for decades. That, hey, why are these young kids going on a life of gang violence instead of, I don't know, focusing on their education and trying to start a career? Yeah, you've been saying, you hear politicians say that. We need to give them another path. Okay, well, what are you doing? So I'm fine with Mayor Bruce Harrell being in the South End talking about, hey, what else can we offer these kids? Can they be linked up with religious organizations that can help them, you know, foster sort of a love and respect for their fellow man and a love and respect for their community in a way that would divert them from the gang life? That's great. I have no issue with that. A plus. However, the idea that you're talking about arresting people who commit acts of violence, as that's like your secondary thought, that I'm not afraid to say that a compassionate approach often will entail arrests as well. It's all about people feeling safe in this great city of Seattle. Yeah, arrests are an obvious response. And if that's what you're bringing to the table for how we're going to deal with this, I just cannot help you, Mayor. It's truly unbelievable to me that the mayor, and we're going to talk about this coming up in our next segment, because it has been a theme that I've seen, that, okay, you have some media outlets who are talking about, you know, the crimes that are happening and what small businesses are dealing with, etc. But it's like they refuse to acknowledge or be forceful or level with people about some of the underlying issues here. Like, we have the lowest number of police officers per capita in the nation. We've vilified police officers and passed laws at the state level that take power away from police and seem to give power and deference to criminals. Like, we have no consequences on the back end when someone commits a violent crime and we cut deals with gun offenders. Why aren't we talking about the obvious reasons why these kids continue to commit acts of violence, because we then coddle them and the criminal justice system does? And why are we treating it like some brave thing for the mayor to say, yeah, our approach should also include arrests? What are we doing? Of course it should. It's just truly unbelievable to me. And again, we're going to continue on with this theme coming up in our next segment. But first, well, you know, add another thing to the list of reasons why people need to save money, the PSC rate hikes connected to the carbon tax. So I've been telling everybody to take the FirstMark challenge. Everybody needs insurance, whether it's homeowners insurance, renters insurance, car insurance. I mean, gosh, ring insurance, which I found out is a thing as soon as I got engaged. So Mike and I took the FirstMark challenge back in the spring. We're now members of the FirstMark family. We love it because we've got one, if there's something that happens, the first people we call is FirstMark. We've got all our insurance under the FirstMark umbrella. We get excellent service from them, and we got much better insurance for the same price. And that's what the FirstMark challenge is about. It's about going to FirstMark, scheduling some time for a Zoom call, if that's what's convenient for you, going through your current insurance, talking to them about your needs. Maybe you need to save a little money, or maybe you need better insurance or more insurance. They go out, they shop the market for you for free. Doesn't cost you anything. They come back and they offer their recommendations. Here's Dave Taylor, the CEO of FirstMark.
We believe and we say that we will help 100% of the people that we work with. Okay. Now that doesn't mean necessarily that 100% of the people we work with are going to become FirstMark clients, but we believe that we will actually help 100% of the people, whether that be stay with your current carrier, but let's modify your coverage a bit so you're better protected, or ultimately, hopefully come over to FirstMark. We're going to put you with a different company and give you better coverage, right? So the challenge is really challenging individuals to give us an opportunity to prove that to them. That's really what the FirstMark challenge is.
Yeah, and I actually got an email from one of our wonderful show viewers who said, hey, I had my mom reach out to FirstMark, and you know what they told her? They told her that her insurance was great and she didn't need to change a thing. So I love that. She did the FirstMark challenge, and instead of lying to her to get her business, they're a good company, veteran-owned, and they said, hey, you actually have really good insurance. I'd keep what you already have and then sent her on her way. Love these people. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you. Even if their answer is that they don't need to do any work for you because you've done great work yourself getting your insurance. Nicole's like, Brandy, can you make these reads a little shorter? No, because I like our show sponsors, okay? All right, the following segment is brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. I was at an event last night down in the Tacoma area, and I ran into a guy who ended up asking a question about business owners. He's got a variety of businesses across Western Washington, also happens to be a candidate for the 8th Congressional District. His name is Nareev Sheth. And he said that he was frustrated because his businesses have been broken into routinely. And he, you know, has reached out to police to no avail. And then he finally reached out to Cairo 7 News and wanted to talk about one of his businesses in Normandy Park that had been broken into for a third time. And he was telling me how he was so disappointed with how the story came out because it didn't talk at all about why is this happening? Why is this happening with such frequency? Here's a little clip from the story.
They had a mask on, they had gloves on, so they were professionals.
In April, other employees at his Des Moines business weren't so lucky.
He pulled a gun on his face.
He says he's made a police report each time something happens, but not one culprit has been found.
And out of 18, I haven't got even a single return phone call from police. Law enforcement saying that we have limited resources right now.
Yeah, but I read this whole story at Cairo 7, and I think there's a couple things going on here. I think that local newsrooms are having a hard time. I think they have really young reporters who maybe aren't familiar with the intricacies of everything going on. But I do think some of it might be political. And it's really unfortunate because here you have this business owner who's like, oh, my God, three times this has happened. And he's desperate. And he's reached out to the police and he's reached out to the media. I mean, I will read. I'm going to just read, if it's okay with Nicole. Don't glare at me. I want to read the full Cairo 7 article.
Okay.
Because I think it perfectly illustrates, and this is his frustration he was expressing to me last night. It says, and I'm going to read the whole thing. A Normandy Park business has been broken into and burglarized for a third time. The thieves busted in through the patio door and left in under 5 minutes around 8 a.m. Saturday morning. The co-owner, Nareev Sheath, said it looked like the three men had done a home invasion before. He said they broke in by prying in the back patio door. They had masks on and gloves on, so they were professionals. It's the third time burglars breached the Bistro Baffy doors. Once the robbers got inside, they split up and headed straight for the register. And then it's another quote from the business owner who says he cut the cables and everything. The register took the register with him. He was trying to open it, da da da. And it says, Sheath did make a police report after Saturday's burglary. Cairo 7 reached out to Normandy Park Police for comment, but did not get a reply. What's missing from that article? Any sort of context or any sort of effort to hold people in power accountable for this environment that's plaguing small businesses. This article is essentially, hey, here's some cool surveillance footage of something happened to this poor freaking business owner. We'll show it to you. Oh, he called the police and nothing. Okay, but why is this happening? Why are businesses with this level of frequency being burglarized? What has contributed to an environment where police don't have enough officers to prioritize the burglary of a business? We have to expect that the media and politicians are going to level with Washingtonians about why this stuff is happening. It's not enough to just say and report, oh, there's been another shooting. You know, we have a record number of shootings. Oh, these businesses are being broken into repeatedly and police aren't able to catch anyone. That's not journalism. That's not reporting. That's not trying to get to the bottom of what's going on. And I really don't mean this segment to be just a segment that's critical about the media, because this extends to politicians as well. No one wants to talk about the truth of what's happening here. And there are several examples of this. We just earlier on the show played that little clip of Bruce Harrell, where he was talking about the shootings that have been plaguing the South End. Here's that clip again.
In our country, we're seeing unprecedented levels of violence and gun misuse, hatred.
And again, he's not acknowledging at all, okay, what is contributing to this? He's blaming it on something simple like, oh, wow, across the country, we have all these shootings. It's unprecedented levels of gun violence. Okay, Mayor, what is leading to unprecedented levels of quote-unquote gun violence in your community? Can we be honest with people? Can we level with people that we have a record low number of police officers, that laws have been passed at the state level that seem to cater to criminals, laws that make it more difficult for police to do their job? Can we look at the broken criminal justice system and say, hey, we've got people who are being caught doing violent crimes and they're being let out the door without any bail? We just had an example of that this past week in Thurston County, where there were six people in a stolen vehicle, all of them juveniles except one, led police on a high-speed chase, committed a hit and run, fled from justice. And what happened? Well, the 18-year-old went to court and a judge said, cut him loose. No requirement of bail at all. We have to talk about, when we're going to talk about, in this instance, the unprecedented levels of stolen vehicles, when we talk about the record number of homicides, when we talk about this story that Cairo 7 glossed over about business owners dealing with break-in after break-in after break-in, we are not doing we're not adding any service to the people of Washington. We're doing them a disservice if we don't get into why this is happening. It's not enough to simply say it's happening. We have a breakdown in the criminal justice system, a lack of respect for the rule of law that has been fostered by politicians who put forth policies that make it more difficult for police officers to do their job. And not only that, they have vilified police officers wholesale for years on end. You don't think politicians vilifying police officers has an impact on how young people view police officers and respect authority? So we owe it to we in the media, we on the Undivided podcast, my friends in corporate mainstream media, every single politician whose job is to serve people. We owe it to Washingtonians to be honest, to level with them about what's happening in our communities and what is contributing to the breakdown in the rule of law. And it is much more complex than simply showing a surveillance video of yet another break-in at a small business and lamenting that the police haven't found the perpetrator yet. All right, that segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. All right, let's step outside of Washington State. Just to watch the media really struggle with new angles on the Trump story is interesting. And I had mentioned last week the story that was done on the jail that Trump was going to be quasi-booked into and how it was, you know, a really dangerous jail. We could put that article back up. And I had just mentioned that this was just one of those silly articles that it's like, I feel like they were just trying to invent narratives to fill coverage. It said, jail where Trump will be booked in Georgia has long been plagued with violence. And then it talked about how this is a violent jail that other people have to wait in months, if not years, to get their day in court. And Donald Trump is getting all this special treatment. I'm like, okay, that's just a completely fabricated narrative that's just meant to divide people even further. And I saw this other one in the Seattle Times, but it's from the New York Times. And we know that newsrooms are so small that basically one story that gets printed somewhere goes to a million other websites. But I couldn't help but look at this and think, well, what are you trying to accomplish with this? The headline, Americans still put their trust in juries. Will Trump's trials break that faith? And I'm thinking, okay, if I just read the headline, I'm like, okay, are you saying that if they don't convict him, then like Americans won't trust juries anymore? Or if they do convict him, then Americans won't trust juries anymore? And they get into this like polling and back and forth about whether people think Trump can get a fair trial, because how could you possibly find someone in America who doesn't have a strong opinion about Donald Trump? But I just have to think that it's almost as if they're, again, we talk on the show about what our purpose is. And it's to reject false narratives that are meant to divide us. And here you have the New York Times that is preemptively saying, you know, no matter what the jury verdict is, you're going to have part of the country who hates it and part of the country who loves it. And it's going to erode our trust in juries and the judicial system and as an institution. It's like, okay, there hasn't even been a trial yet. They just set the trial date. Probably going to be pushed back over and over. And you're already trying to divide us based on whether a jury that hasn't even been chosen and seated yet can treat Trump fairly, and if they convict him or don't convict him, you're already trying to tell us that it's going to make a big segment of the country even madder than they already are. And again, it's just a story they put out there. What other angle can we do? And all it's doing is deepening divisions and creating problems that might exist in the future, but that don't even exist right now. It's ridiculous stuff. And I'll say, I didn't pull this for the show today because I kind of forgot about it, Nicole. But there's 18 co-defendants I think Trump has in Georgia. They're all white except one. One of them is black. And to watch the media flail trying to cover this was interesting, because the sole black co-defendant of Donald Trump is the only one who wasn't granted bail initially by the first appearance trial judge. And I think it was it NBC or something? So now here they have this black guy who they're like, he's the only one of the 18 who wasn't given bail. And so it's this real struggle, this internal struggle between, okay, well, we kind of have to feel bad for him because he's black and we've made it clear that identity is the only thing that matters and he's the only black co-defendant. But at the same time, he supported Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. So how do we paint him as a sympathetic figure or not sympathetic, or what do we do? And it was just a really interesting effort on the media. But it was because, and I agree, that doesn't look great. It's like the only black guy out of all these people is the one not granted bail. But it's because he had a pending case related to alleged assault on a federal officer who had tried to show up and I think give him a subpoena or something to court. So there was an underlying issue because he had that case already pending that the judge said, you know, bail is going to be revisited at a different date, but this gives us reason to be concerned you might not come to court. But just interesting. Okay, one more national story. Oh, this was the age issue. So I have said that I don't think age per se is a disqualifier for someone to be president or not be president. I think it just depends on the person, right? And it depends on us using common sense and putting our political bias and preferences aside and saying, is that person of whatever age capable of doing the job? And I think when you look at Joe Biden and you listen to Joe Biden, the answer has to be no. Unless you are that highly partisan, the answer has to be no. So anyway, Fox News ran this, there was this poll, and it was interesting. It said, overwhelming majority of Americans say Biden is too old to be effective in a second term, but they didn't find that for Donald Trump. And I actually think that's pretty accurate, because to me, that tells me that Americans are willing to look past just the age as a number, because the poll found 69% of Democrats said Biden is too old to run again. That is really significant. It was an Associated Press NORC poll that said in total 77% of Americans say Biden is too old to carry out a second term. 89% of Republicans said that, 69% of Democrats, but fewer than half of Americans said Donald Trump is too old to hold office, and he's just 3 years younger than Joe Biden. And so, again, I think that underscores, like, Americans are smart, they're intelligent. Hopefully, you know, they'll be able to put their reason when it comes to Biden's age ahead of their personal political preferences, and maybe encourage their party to find someone younger and more up to the task to be able to run again. But yeah, Americans can look past the number of age. I don't agree with the sentiment that there should be a, because you have to be 35 to run for president. I don't agree with the sentiment that there should be a max age. I am also not sure I agree. And this was a debate question, right, Nicole? This was a debate question, is do you think there should be like a mental acuity test to make sure, right, something like that.
Something like that, yeah. There was something close to that. But.
And I agreed with what most of the candidates said, which is, no, I trust the American people to make that judgment. And I tend to agree. I don't want to put undue restrictions on the American people when it comes to who they can nominate, who they can vote for. Although, then you have somebody like Biden. Biden was much better on the campaign trail, though. He devolved pretty quickly in the first year, like from a mental perspective, I think. I mean, right. Did he have issues on the campaign trail? Yes, he certainly did.
He got to hide out in the basement. So
yes, he was hiding. That's true.
We couldn't really tell if he was having issues other than that.
Yes.
So,
that is a very good point.
I do think that the age thing, that everybody is different at whatever age. However, it is an alternative to term limits, right? Because most have been in politics so long,
yeah,
and to get a limit on that and term limits and things like that would take so much work. Just using age as the okay, like, you can retire now. See you later, please.
That is interesting, a way to sort of force them out of office. But then I go back to, I believe the power should be closest to the people. And so are you going to limit, if you have someone who's really doing a great job and they've served a district for such a long time in Congress, and, you know, I know you have Dianne Feinstein and she clearly cannot do her job, but isn't that ultimately up to the people of her district to decide, do we send her back?
Yeah, I guess it's the corruption behind it and how they're often, you know, bought and placed, and then they get in there and they don't have to get anything done because there's no limit, right? There's no term limit, there's no age limit, there's nothing. And that would be kind of a way to get around some of the corruption back there.
Yeah, I struggle with that because I also do agree that is it really allowing voters to choose if the party is basically choosing for you? So you have someone like Dianne Feinstein, and it's very considered taboo for Democrats or for Republicans to challenge a sitting person of their own party. So then as long as that person wants to stay in that seat, they're there. And is that really a choice for voters when you have, again, party politics creating that environment? So yeah, I like the idea of term limits. I'm not sure I like the idea of some artificial age cap. I know people in their 90s who are like sharp as a tack, who have all this life experience. And I'm like, yeah, they'd be great in Congress. So, but term limits, I think, is a little different. I think I'd be more apt to support term limits for members of Congress. Certainly for
Congress
governors
would
of
have
Washington.
To approve it, though, and so it'll never happen.
We'll see. Yeah. I think that there are people in both parties who recognize that, hey, like the Dianne Feinstein thing, people can't be dying in their seats. You know what I mean? And certainly there are Republicans who I think understand that as well. And there's a lot of younger members of Congress too, who are coming up, who've been kind of vocal about that. So Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Okay, we'll get to your questions and comments from the feed coming up just momentarily. But first, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. I was up at the lake, Lake Havanah, if you guys know where this, like Mount Baker area, this weekend. And the friends I went up to visit, they're like big picture takers. And they make this little book every year at the end of the year with all their highlights from the year. And I was looking in their book from last year, and it shows me out at their lake the exact same time last year, like 40 pounds heavier. And I was like, wow, I did lose a lot of weight. So I was like, please put these pictures in your book for next year, because I've lost now more than 36 pounds at this point on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. I've loved the results. I have multiple friends who are on the program now as well. This is Ben and Leslie. I met a couple. I like couples that do it together. Mm-hmm. You know, the couple that perseveres together. Just
Mike's great. Not in on it yet.
No, Mike's not in on it yet. Mike or Ben and Leslie, who I've met a couple times now, we took a picture together because we were down collectively 101 pounds, which I think is pretty cool. So EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. It's your chance to sort of ask questions and see if the program is right for you, or maybe it's not right for you, but you can get those questions in before you commit to it. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Okay, questions and comments from the live stream. Matthew Quick. Cook with a $10 super chat. Thank you, Matthew. Chris Reichdahl defines loss of learning as not losing what you've previously learned. I contend that if you're at a third grade level and you should be at a fourth grade level, that's also loss of learning. And I agree with your assessment of that, Matthew Cook. Kathy Carr says, Chris Reichdahl is a true politician. His responses to Brandy were total crap. Many cannot afford to approve a levy with property taxes being so high. Yes, and for the other reasons I articulated, okay, you've lost students. Then you don't need that money. Why would the state continue to give you money for students that you don't have anymore? That's when you have to budget. Greg said, like Car... Oh, that's true. I didn't even think of that. Greg Sheehan said that school districts creating a budget based off money they're hoping will manifest is like Clark Griswold betting on his Christmas bonus for a pool. That's the best example
analogy.
I've had.
Yes,
exactly. Oh, poor Clark. But he actually eventually got that bonus. It took a lot of criminal acts, including kidnapping, to get the bonus. Well, accessory to kidnapping. But Diana Manning says, there is no gray area about teacher strikes. They are illegal in Washington state. I agree with you. But again, do you think for a second that Bob Ferguson would come out and say, the teachers union needs to stop this illegal strike? No, he's too busy going after Value Village and wasting taxpayer funds. All right, on the carbon tax, and what I think is one of the most scandalous stories at the government level that I have seen in a decade in Washington state covering politics. It's truly bad. Sharon Barber says, if this policy were popular, the Dems would have to lie about it. If this policy was popular, the Dems wouldn't have to lie about it every damn time. And I agree. If people liked it and they were willing to sacrifice a little bit of money because they really believe this is going to help the environment, then Dems should just own that and Dem voters would own that. But you have to hide it because it's not popular. Rachel Cisneros says, every single news station and newspaper needs to report this. I will say I was very impressed with King 5's headline. Can you look up King 5's reporting on this? Because the headline was like blunt. And I was like, wow, did that come from Woke 5 News? I was very, very impressed. On Patreon, Y says, so they told us that the company would already not pass the tax. Did you find it?
It's already out of there. I'll find it.
Patreon, or Y said on Patreon, so they told us the company will not pass the tax laws to the consumers to make it up. Lo and behold, they do. And the politicians who are supposed to be working for us tell the company to lie to us so they won't look bad. I hate politicians. 3% is huge. Yeah, that's an exact summary of what they did, which is so insane. Again, defend it. Send to me, if you're somebody who thinks you can defend that, defend it. And we will reach out for comment to the AG's office and to the governor's office as well. On Bob Ferguson setting his date, September 9th, to launch his official campaign for governor, despite the fact that it's been official for some time, he says, Rick said, the exploratory campaign statement is just another typical Bob Ferguson untruth. He must really think people are stupid. I hope the state of Washington does not prove him right. You and me both. Oh, snort jar. I haven't snorted in so long.
You haven't. You've done very well.
Okay. I'll give you a dollar after the show.
Okay.
H said, I hope Reichert uses this PSC information when he's out making speeches, 100%. Mugshot Espresso says, I love it when Brandy goes on a rant. Yes, feeling very ranty today. On Mayor Bruce Harrell and his genius idea for how to prevent crime and how to deal with crime. Arrest people? You don't say. Paul Wright says, unfortunately, the Democratic Party has been overtaken by communists. And every Democrat votes the way they are told to. Sad day for America. I don't believe that. I don't think every Democrat votes the way they're told to. A lot do. And a lot of Republicans vote the way that they're told to. But we need more people to break free.
Right.
Break free. Lolly Wilson says, all the criminals know Washington State is a criminal's paradise. Exactly. Did you find the King 5 headline?
No. Makes me suspicious that it got pulled.
Well, I don't know. No, I think it's probably out there somewhere. But it was good. It was just like, they're told to hide the raids. And I was like, wow, King 5 did this story. I just want to cry almost. I love it so much.
Okay. We're going to have to make sure that that's up somewhere.
All right. We'll revisit it.
I'll find
it. Note that for tomorrow's show.
Deal.
Note. Okay, will Noted. You take yourself off camera so I can get to my sanity check? And I'm just sick of looking at you. I'm just kidding.
Ouch. Wow.
I'm just kidding. You're
you got me all day.
You're a total too. Babe. I know. I'm making Nicole stay at work until like 9 p.m. tonight. So good person. I'm going to have to like look away because you're blinding beauty.
Aww.
Okay, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? Kind of a different one today. So I mentioned this event I was at last night, and it was great. We were invited by the Virginia Taylor Club down in Pierce County to come speak about independent media. My friend Jonathan Cho and I went, and we answered questions from folks. And, you know, I thought it was really touching that this group really understands the value of what we're trying to do. And, you know, not trying to be mouthpieces for Republicans, but trying to hold people in power accountable, which is supposed to be the job of the media. And the people power here are Democrats, and to just be fair, you know, to be fair and not vilify every single thing Republicans do out of some, you know, mistaken belief that you have to in order to be accepted in the media environment here. But anyway, this interesting topic came up, and I think it is something I haven't thought about often and talked about often when it comes to how can we restore sanity to Washington State? How can we restore balance? I think, you know, your support of independent media, certainly our show, I think is helpful. You know, that is our goal, to bring balance back to the state of Washington and try to reject some of these totally ridiculous things that are pushed forth by the mainstream media without any criticality. But one of the things I brought up, and I encourage you to do as well, you know, I don't need the corporate media to fail. I don't care. I don't care if they're doing well. I don't care if they're not doing well. They're not doing well, by the way, from everyone from the Seattle Times to, you know, my old employers and TV news, and ratings are so low. They're not doing well. But what I encouraged people last night, what I would encourage you to do as well, if sanity is important to you and common sense is important to you, is not to passively or even unintentionally support media outlets who are contributing to these fake divisions in our state. And what do I mean by that? So that means that if you're unhappy with the way that the media is covering things, if you're unhappy with the way that a TV station is covering something, if you're unhappy with the way that a newspaper is covering something, that means that you don't share their content. You don't consume their content. You make a point not to use their advertisers and to reach out to their advertisers, not to be mean, not to cancel anyone, but to say, hey, you advertise on this station. I really think this station isn't being honest about what's happening in our state with the crime crisis. And I wanted you to know that that's why I'm not going to be watching that station anymore, not going to be contributing to their ratings anymore. But it's also, I think, goes a step further than that. I think there's a lot of times that, I mean, ratings is one thing, but TV stations and newspapers, they rely right now so much on clicks, on you sharing stories, commenting on their stories, liking their stories. And I would encourage you, because the only way to improve the media environment, and we need the media environment to improve in order to get balance and sanity back to the state of Washington, that has to happen. In order to do that, their pocketbooks have to hurt. That is the only reason. I'm telling you, the only way that they will take a serious look at what they're doing or not doing is if they are so financially strapped, they have to have a come to Jesus and say, why aren't people supporting us? Why aren't people watching us? Why aren't people consuming us? So you might see a headline, for instance, come across your feed on Facebook. I want you to look at, rather than just reading the headline and saying, oh, I'm going to share this or comment, I want you to look at who the headline is from. And if it is a station, a newspaper, who you believe has not been operating fairly, I don't want you to engage with it at all. Don't like it. Don't comment on it. Don't blindly share it, because that's what it's going to take. I don't need a destruction. We don't need a destruction of mainstream media. But in order to restore sanity, we need them to learn a lesson. about what happens when you alienate and vilify a whole half of the population. So it's just something that came up last night that I thought was interesting, is not just supporting independent media or media outlets that you think are doing a really good job, even if they're corporate media outlets, but actively looking at how might I be propping up these other media outlets, even if it's not intentionally, and how can I change that moving forward? So anyway, good show today, guys. Is that complimenting myself? Good show today, Nicole.
Yeah, good show today.
I don't know. I'm just, I was, guys, I came yourself. In a little late today. This is behind the curtains. We'll talk about it on the live chat today. I'm just super stressed. I'll be honest.
I'm really stressed out. How many days?
I've got 4 weeks left to the wedding. Mm-hmm. I'm trying not to let the wedding stress me out, but I think between this and that, it's taking all my energy out of other things. And like, I've been left with zero time for myself. And so I was just told Nicole today, I said, hey, I'm going to be late today. I got to just get stuff done. I've got loads of laundry sitting at my house mm-hmm. in baskets. I've got crap all over the place. And I've got two dogs looking at me like, what are we going to do today? And I'm just like, oh my God, I'm neglecting my life. I love you guys. I do. But I've just been a little stressed out. So I just wanted you to know, you know, I share.
Well,
is it too much?
You're dealing with it well.
TMI. But that being said, we'll be here till 9 p.m. because we're going to do a live Q&A. Every month we do a live Q&A with subscribers where you can come. You can ask us any questions. And Nicole is going to be here. This is the first one you've done. Right?
Correct.
Be prepared. I've been promising it. We couldn't get the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. But tonight at 7 p.m. for Undivided subscribers, we'll have our live Q&A. So please join us on Locals or Patreon. If you have not signed up, it's not too late to join our Q&A tonight. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. Sign up. Join our Q&A tonight. Go back and watch Sundays with Subscribers with Chris Reichdahl from yesterday. It was an interesting interview. Apparently some people are a little angsty with his answers, but...
Or Reichdahl.
Oh, shoot. Reichdahl. It's Reichdahl, not Reichdahl. Old habits die hard. All right, you guys. I promise I'm fine. Don't worry about me. See you tonight on the live chat on UndividedPod.com. And then I'll see the rest of you back on the live show tomorrow at noon.